And now,
great to be back.
Back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
Awesome.
And your host, Bill Frank.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to the Bill Frank Radio Show on KVTA News Talk 1520. I'm bringing fresh perspectives to Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is things that impact our lives. Each of my guests will discuss his or her subject and relate it to current events. My next guest is the leading authority on the social history of the Olympic Games in London. We'll discuss the 1948 Olympics based on her book, The Austerity Olympics. Janie Hampton is the author of 15 books, including social history, biography, fiction, and textbooks. She has written articles for all the major British newspapers, including The Independent, The Guardian, The Daily Telegraph, The New Statesman, and The Author. She has been a journalist in Zimbabwe, Kenya, Congo, and Uganda, traveling by canoe, bus, riverboat, and train. Janie has advised on many programs about the Olympics on BBC, radio, and television. She is the director of the Chauncey Maples Malawi Trust, which is renovating Africa's oldest ship back to a clinic on Lake Malawi. Jane's daughter, Daisy, interestingly enough, nominated her for the Tesco Mum of the Year Award for her work with the people of Malawi. Joining us from a location just outside of London to escape the games, Janie, how are you tonight?
I'm very well.
Good. I'm happy to have you as a guest on the show. Thank you very much for being a guest. Now, it's interesting to me that London is the only city in the world to host the Olympic Games three times, and the 1948 Olympic Games were known as the Austerity Olympics. So the place I want to start with is with the whole total cost of the Olympics and things like that. At the time, Great Britain spent £730,000, which is roughly the equivalent of $1,100,000 to host the Games.
It's more like $30 million today.
Well, that didn't adjust it for inflation. That's right. So it's $30 million today. But here's the point of the question. The bigger question is, here's Great Britain after World War II. They're nearly bankrupt by the Second World War. It's still on government rationing of food. You know, why did Great Britain accept the challenge of hosting the first Olympic Games since the 1936 Berlin Games?
Well, many Britons said it was a silly idea. The British government said, look, we've just come through the Second World War. We really can't afford this. But the leading sportsmen of Britain, who were gentlemen of high military rank and aristocrats, said, well, we've just been through a war. We know how to organize things. We know how to get things going in a very short time. We think we can do it. And the government said, well, you get on with it, but we can't actually give you any money to do so. So the London Organizing Committee had 2 years, but they'd done it before. In 1908, they also only had 2 years to arrange the Olympics because Rome was supposed to host it, but there was a little matter of Mount Vesuvius going up as in volcanic ash. And the Italians said, look, we're far too busy with our volcano. We can't possibly do the Olympics. And London stepped in and did the whole thing in just over a year. London's pretty good at doing that.
They're very plucky. There's no question about that. And kudos to them for actually pulling it off in such a short amount of time. But why did the Olympic organizers, the other side of that equation, why did they agree to host the Olympic Games? And I'm going to take the position of Avery Brundage of the United States, who was an IOC member at the time. He wanted the Games right here in California, in Los Angeles, instead of Great Britain. And of course, Avery Brundage, as many people know, eventually had a lot of sway with the IOC. So why did the Olympic Committee allow them to have it in London, this bombed-out city that is still on food rationing?
Well, they knew that very few people would have been able to get to Los Angeles. There were very few ships going across the Atlantic, even less aeroplanes. It was very difficult to get over there. People just didn't have the money in Europe to get to America. So, yes, I'm sure that the people of Los Angeles could have put it on very well, but not many people other than North Americans would have turned up. They'd never held an Olympics in Asia or Australasia at that time, and there again, transport would have been too difficult. So it was easier to bring the American team over to Britain. Ironically, London was the best placed city in Europe. Paris was in a worse state. Helsinki, who were going to have the 1940 Olympics, but there was a small matter of the Second World War and the invasion of their country stopped them. They were in an even worse state. And London just said, come on, let's see what we can do. We'll just make do and mend. We're very good at that. And they went round looking for venues. Nothing was built. They used whatever was available. So Wembley Stadium was a greyhound racetrack, and they removed the greyhounds and replaced it with athletics track. Herne Hill Velodrome, which had been built about 50 years before for cycling, had been a site for barrage balloons in the war. And they cleared those away, and they chopped down the grass that was on the cycle track. So they just sort of made do with what they had. King George VI lent his back garden, otherwise known as Windsor Great Park, for the cycle road race. The tarmac was in a terrible state. It was full of holes, but the cyclists raced round and round and round quite happily.
My guest is Janie Hampton. She's author of the book, The Austerity Olympics, When the Games Came to London in 1948. So, Janie, most people listening to the sound of our voice really don't have a sense of what Great Britain was like following the Second World War. So give us an idea of the living conditions in 1948 Britain.
In 1948, the food rationing was stricter than it had been during the war. Each adult was allowed 2,500 calories a day. That was included one egg a week, no sweets, no chocolate. Children had the best teeth they've ever had because they had no sweets. And although it was a very small diet, it was a balanced diet. If you were an Olympian, you had to train on that until you were selected for the team, at which point you were allowed enough, the same amount of calories as a coal miner, which was 3,500 calories. A modern Olympian trains on 7,000 or 8,000. So that was the food. The roads were full of potholes. There was petrol rationing. Very few people had cars anyway. It was even difficult getting bicycle tyres. The cyclists who took part in the Olympics were lent tyres by Dunlop, but if they'd accepted them as gifts, that would have made them professionals. They had to be very careful about keeping their amateur status, which was much stricter in those days. Housing was very limited. A lot of houses had been bombed. The army had come back. All the soldiers had come back and had to be housed. There were still German prisoners of war in Britain, even in 1948. So how were they going to house the Olympians? Well, what they did was they took over an RAF camp and an army camp for some of the teams, and then they closed many of the schools in London a week early, and they took the desks out of the classrooms and moved in beds and put up curtains, and they turned the school canteens into nice dining rooms with tablecloths, and local housewives brought bunches of flowers. So it was a matter of everybody pulling together and making do with what they could.
Was the world accepting of this, Janie? Did they know that these were going to be the austerity Olympics?
I think they probably did, because all the nations were invited to contribute. So, for example, the Swiss brought gymnastic equipment. The Finnish brought timber to mend the floor of the basketball stadium. And the Americans flew over every single day from Los Angeles food. And it arrived, much to everyone's amazement. There was fresh steak. There was bread that was better quality than they'd had in 8 years. In fact, it was such good bread, it was technically illegal in Britain.
Why is that?
Well, there were rules about how good quality you were allowed to make bread. And they had to just ignore the rules because the American bread was so good.
My guest is Janie Hampton. We're talking about the Austerity Olympics. Give us an idea then of the medals, for example, in the Olympics of 1948. Gold medals, were they actually made out of gold?
No, I don't think they've ever been made out of solid gold, but they did manage to make them. But they didn't have a ribbon in those days. They just came in a box. And there was a shortage of brass bands to play the national anthems. So there was a bit of a worry there. But they did play the Stars and Stripes a lot. The American team won more medals than anyone in sport, but they didn't do so well in the other medals, which were about in the 1948 Olympics, which was art.
Art?
Yes. 1948 was the last time that the Olympics featured medals for painting, sculpture, poetry, architecture, musical composition. Canada won a medal for a composition for flute and piano. The French won the gold medal for etching. And you can imagine it was pretty difficult to judge. For the poetry, the bronze medal was won by the French, the silver by an Afrikaans poet from South Africa, and the gold by a Finnish poet. Now, can you imagine trying to judge poetry in all those languages?
No, I can't. I mean, that must have been quite a challenge for the judges. And I just can't imagine judges sitting there reading poetry and flashing those cards, 9.0, 9.8, etc. My guest is Janie Hampton, author of the book, The Austerity Olympics, When the Games Came to London in 1948. Interestingly, Janie, I mean, you talked about that was the last time for the arts in the Olympics. Technology actually played a role in the 1948 Olympics. You had mentioned that Wembley Stadium was a Greyhound track before that. Because it was a Greyhound track, it gave us one of the great advancements in judging finals of races for the first time. Talk to us about some of the technological innovations that came about in 1948.
Oh, there were some great improvements. There was the photo finish, which was needed in the 100-meter final when six men looked to the naked eye as if they'd all come almost equal.
Wow.
And, in fact, the first and second were both from the United States. And in those days, it wasn't thousandths of a second. It was sort of a tenth of a second. But Harrison Dillard won in 10.3 seconds, which was incredibly fast then. And certainly nobody would have seen with the naked eye. The other difference from 48 was that it was the first time it was televised throughout Britain or wherever there was television. We'd only had television since 1945. So not that many people had it, and if somebody had a television in your street, then they just had a party the whole time and everybody piled in. The screens were tiny.
Yes.
And black and white, and you couldn't really see very much, but it was jolly exciting. They also made the first ever colour feature documentary film, and that was quite a challenge because they didn't have enough colour cameras in the country. So they had to adapt them to black and white, and they didn't want to upset the spectators, so they dug a pit to put the camera in. Unfortunately, the pit filled up with water, and the poor cameramen were standing up to their waists in rainwater.
Oh, my. Wow, what a mess. Now, Wembley Stadium itself used a track surface that had never been used before. Talk to us about that, if you will.
Well, previously, the sort of surface that athletics took place in, you could literally dig it with a trowel, and sprinters would go with their own trowel to dig a little hole to put their feet in. This was a new track made out of ashes from the halves of Leicester in the Midlands and very finely compacted. So they had to have starting blocks, and many sprinters had never seen these before. And they turned up with their trowels and found they couldn't actually dig a little hole. They had to put their foot in a starting block.
Of course, we take starting blocks for granted now. My guest is Janie Hampton, author of the book, The Austerity Olympics. So, Janie, this was following World War II, and you have to wonder, you know, what countries were able to come there because of the economy and other things. Who competed in the 1948 Olympics?
Well, there were 59 nations competing altogether. But it's probably easier to note the ones that didn't come. Japan was not invited, and nor was Germany. They'd taken part in previous Olympics, but it was considered it was just too close to the Second World War to have them. We still had prisoners of war living here. The Koreans came for the first time, because before the war they had been invaded by Japan, and one or two Korean Olympians had competed on behalf of Japan before. Sadly, a group of Koreans went to the pub in Wembley and were mistaken as Japanese, and there was a bit of a fisticuffs fight ensued.
Mm.
The Russians, the Soviets, wanted to come, but it was pointed out to them that they hadn't actually set up an Olympic committee since their revolution of 1917. And they were sent the forms to do this, but then they blockaded Berlin, which made them not very popular with Britain or the United States, who were stuck in Berlin, and so they were not encouraged to come. So I did find evidence that the Soviet embassy had bought tickets for every single event, and apparently Stalin had said, could you please send me notes on these Olympics? I want to see whether we ought to be involved next time.
Interesting. Now, Janie, you mentioned all the protagonists in World War II except one, Italy. Italy was on the side of the Axis, and as you said, there was animosity towards Germany and Japan because of what had happened in the war. Italy was accepted into the Games. How did that occur?
Well, that was because Italy became an ally before the end of the war. So they were considered one of our friends. So they were allowed to compete.
All right. Well, looking at the Olympics, one of the highlights of any Olympics are the opening ceremonies. Talk to us about the opening ceremonies of the 1948 Games. They were probably more modest than we saw in the 2012 London Olympics.
They were very much more modest, but I've spoken to some of the Olympic athletes who were there, some of the Boy Scouts, some of the organizers, some of the audience, and they said it was absolutely fantastic. There were 80,000 people in Wembley Stadium. It was the hottest day for 50 years. Standing outside were 59 nations, standing in a bomb site, sitting on piles of rubble. There was no canteen, there was no shade. They were all sweltering. Inside was the Grenadier Guards brass band. All their instruments were out of tune because it was so hot. But they played marching tunes. The king was there, saluted each team as they came in, and there was this huge roar of approval because for the first time since the war, all these nations had come together in peace. And when the team of Malta, which was one man who ran 100 meters, and he ran in the first heat and he came last, but there was this mighty roar for him because Malta had survived the war. And then the British came in last. And some of the British Olympians said to me, we were just in tears. We just couldn't believe it. But it was all over and we were marching in happily.
It's an amazing story. My guest has been Janie Hampton, author of the book, The Austerity Olympics, When the Games Came to London in 1948. Janie, the time just flies by too quickly. If people are intrigued by what you have to say, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go?
They can go to my website, which is called www.janiehampton.co.uk.
JanieHampton.co.uk. Janie, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you.
Thank you.